Hello, and today at Uncle Data we have Thomas Ivanaitis, who's head of data engineering at Surfshark. He's also a mentor in two organizations. So one is Woman Go Tech, another one is Idealogue, if I did pronounce that correctly.
Yes, you did. So hello, Thomas.
Hey, so as always, we're trying in this podcast, we're trying to cover, you know, different angles, different companies and their strategies or their ways of working. And today we're going to talk about Thomas' career and how he ended up where he is now and what the challenges and so on. So before we, of course, you know, dive into the, you know, the most interesting details about his day to day and his responsibilities, it's always amazing to know, you know, how he developed and how he grew to that role. So can you share about your career experiences and background?
Okay, so first of all, really nice to be in this podcast. So I wrote to you, Thomas, after your like first podcast. And yeah, and it took me more than 20 of your podcasts to be here. So it's nice. So yeah, my career is growing. So yeah, I actually interesting career because I started as a programmer. Let's say it was a data extraction specialist, but basically it was a .NET developer at the company named Infair. And then I started working with the data. So it was more as a, yeah, it was more as a ETL stuff. It was more as a data analyst stuff, but it wasn't, you know, the position, and I didn't always work like that. So I started with that, and then our company started looking at the data engineer position, which was kind of new because data in data world, data analysts like previous or data scientists did most of the stuff. Yeah, so data analysts did data engineering stuff, analytics engineering, ML ops, whatever. Yeah, then the data scientists came, they started building data things. And so data engineering was pretty new to me, and I became data engineer in the same company, Infair. And then, well, yeah, lobby screen opened to me, and I got like hundreds of LinkedIn messages, and everybody wants data engineers, and you know, went to another company, consultancy, also as a data engineer. Then wrote. After like 3-4 months, I went to another company, and it was like almost data engineering. Although I started to do some lecturing in Code Academy, and found myself as a pretty good, let's say, leader, as a pretty good manager, because yeah, like lecturing is pretty similar role as a team lead, yeah, and yeah, especially for example, Turing College has senior team lead roles, yeah, which is again. As a lecturer. So I found it, and after some time, I joined Barbora as a data engineering team lead. And Surfshark wrote me after almost a year that they need to start building everything basically from scratch. And I like to build everything from scratch. I really like this challenge. So yeah, I'm right. I joined as a team lead, and after half a year, maybe more, but became a head of data engineering, which is not that many positions actually in Lithuania with this title. But yeah, managed to do that. So
nice. Like I guess, yeah. Well, for me, it's like the periods, you know, how you grow, you know, one company, another, you figure out a lot of kind of things, what you like, you know, what you don't like, and you pick up a lot of different approaches, actually, which gives you a nice boost.
Actually, I think I got lucky to choose data engineering position at that time. Right now, probably it's more hard to do that, but at that time, it was, you know, I had experience of 1 year, and I worked as a senior data engineer, for example. So it's probably not possible right now, but at that time it was like I got lucky. That's it.
Yeah, it's 2020, right, or 2021?
Yeah, 2020, yeah. 2021.
It's before, you know, it was too of a hype, and like everyone started going in. So yeah, that's nice. So what like actual components of data engineering got you attracted into this, right, and kept you mm-hmm. like hooks in?
Yeah, so at that time, well, as I said, I was a programmer and I work with data. So, you know, it's a really easy path in this case. So I really like programming and I was good at data. I understand the data. I know I have actually master degrees in data science. So I still want to become a data person. Yeah, but I really like programming. So that's why I chose data engineering. It was an opportunity at that time and I found it really interesting. And of course, at that time, it wasn't so many, you know, modern data stack that is right now. So you have to do more programming. But then I found that there's like way easier stuff that can be done in easier way. So yeah, this is what attracted me to the data engineering position and not, for example, data analyst or data scientist, which I didn't become at all.
Yeah, but kind of it makes sense, like what you said, right? Because data engineering has like both of those aspects, right? The data and, as you mentioned, like software engineering. So it's the sweet spot, actually, I guess. And that actually makes sense a lot. And you mentioned, you know, you becoming a team lead, you know, and the mentor and like those things are clicking. But let's talk before that, let's talk about like the challenges or like the difficulties you faced actually when transitioning to a lead role, right? Because it's a change in your day-to-day routine. It's a change in actually, you know, priorities and like other things you have to deal with. So how did transition happen? You know, what did you see, you know, in yourself? How things evolved over the time?
Well, yeah, I just actually want to summarize what you just asked me. Actually, this is people things, you know, things are the most challenging. And you are bringing those soft things home and thinking about it over the weekend, you know. So at the beginning, of course, it was a challenge because, well, each of the individual, you have to, you know, there's no default rules for, you know, how to make them happy, you know, for every person. So I think the biggest challenge is not to bring everything home. And I cannot say I'm perfect at that right now, even with this, but yeah, at the beginning, of course, it was really hard. And of course, you have to show that you are a team lead. There is a probably difference when you are becoming inside of the company as a team lead and when you are coming to the company as a team lead, and there's a huge difference. So when you are joining the team for like six people in my case, so you have to show that you can be a team lead and you have to build the system, the trust policies and so on. So it was really, really difficult. When I joined Surfshark, it was easier. It was a way smaller team. So, you know, that's why it was let's say easier to me. Of course, you have to change the books sometimes, the even the movies sometimes. And you're, for example, when I'm looking into the office, the TV series right now, it's way different when it was 2 years ago. Yeah, I'm looking into Michael Scott, and it's like way, way different approaches that he's doing.
Nice. Okay, and but I guess, like you mentioned, your situation also in Barbara and like in Surfshark were a bit mm-hmm. different, right? And Barbara joined a bigger team, so they already had, you know, already built relationships inside, and you have to go through all of the, you know, gaining the trust, you know, actually showing, you know, skills. And I think in Surfshark when you joined, it was a way smaller team, and you were just building it up, right? So I guess that also helped for all of this to, you know, smooth over.
Yeah, of course. It's well, it's not way less people. It was four people in Surfshark when I joined, but still, you know, the experience of the people was also different. You know, that in Barbora we have more diversity in the team, like more people from other countries. In here we have like everyone is living here, so it was different. The different experience, but of course I also had more experience as a team lead, and it was, as I said, easier to me.
Okay, and so you mentioned, you know, things not bringing, you know, what you like absorb at work, right? Not bringing that home. Any tips, you know, for people listening in, you know, like how to separate in these soft roles, right? These things.
Well, yeah, actually, no tip for that. No tip for that. You just have to live with that. You just have to build experience, and that's it. I don't think it's possible, especially if you are the you know, the people who like stressing things and so on. So of course, you, if you become team lead, it will be hard for you not to take everything home. So for me, just to live with it, take more experience, and that's it. Probably the best tip in this case. I don't think it's possible. There is no such kind of, you know, guideline how to not bring everything home. Just not to bring, it's not the tip.
Yeah, it's, I guess, you know, like, it's not possible because we're not machines and we cannot turn that off, right? Like a snap.
But maybe it's a good thing overall. Maybe it's a good thing that shows that you are not a robot, as you said. So maybe it's a good thing. Of course, all the issues should be bring to home and, you know, to show to your girlfriend and, you know,
yep,
other things.
Yep. But that's actually what makes a leader. Right, because you have empathy and you show it, you know, like, you know, by gathering it, thinking, processing it, and like adding to your, you know, how to react or act in certain situations afterwards, or like just in general with your relationship with people. Okay, how much hands on are you now? Right, like I think your team is how big of?
It's 9 people.
9. Oh crap! Yep. Oh crap! So a lot of meetings. I guess, you know, one-to-one, team meetings, you know, plannings and these kind of things. Are you still much hands-on?
Yes. So our team is, it's pretty big. Well, at least on paper, but still we have, our backlog is huge because like people are seeing the benefits to have the engineering, separate engineering team, and we are the central team. So the backlog is pretty huge. So the hands-on job of mine is basically, you know, to help the team to finish the sprint, to finish the quarter. If I need to split it, I would say like between 15 and 20% of my work is hands-on. Because, you know, I also doing the peer reviews. Yeah, I also doing such kind of stuff, the strategy stuff, which is also, hands-on. So I would say something like that, but the goal for me is to reduce it to 10% and, you know, to hire more people and to have additions that I don't need to do any hands-on, and I can focus on the strategy more, because this is the key, I would say, to build the great data team, not only engineering team, so yeah.
No, that's fair. That's a bit interesting, let's say, because I tend to see, you know, a bit different approaches. Let's see for myself, right? I was in leading roles and like now I'm super happy back hands-on, right? Not doing people-related matters at this point. And it's like, it's way refreshing and like hearing you this. So I guess we just had different experiences, which led us to way different paths. So that's nice to hear, you know, that at this point, you know, you're happy, I'm happy, you know, and actually for anyone listening is actually, you know, not every path, like you don't have to follow anyone else's footsteps actually to or to become someone else, right? Look what works for you best and what makes you happy. Like that's the most important thing. And while I ended the sweet talk, right? So for me, it's, you know, you mentioned strategy and these things. And I'm like, okay, so let's talk shop now, right? So you joined Surfshark. I saw on LinkedIn it was like anniversary a year ago, right?
It will be at the end of November. So, you know, LinkedIn.
Ah,
doing LinkedIn
one
stuff,
month ago.
But, but it's in the end of November. Yeah,
okay, like so how did in general the stack or like, you know, everything looked, right? As much as you can go to the details if possible, okay. Right? And how it changed over the time and how your strategy actually, you know, how you created the strategy, right? The path from where you started and where you are now.
Okay, so that's a huge topic actually. So I will try to, you know, from where I should start. So maybe when I joined Surfshark, so of course the biggest challenge for me was the different industry, because this is security company, you know, and the different things. For example, we're no logs policy, so that means basically we have no logs based on user behavior. Yeah, so there was actually no user information at all in our databases. And it was different when I worked in Barbora. So that was a huge game changer. But okay, I took the challenge. When I came to Surfshark, so it was four people, and two of them was dedicated to one domain, and two people was like dedicated to the whole domains. Like, and we have the domains like around like 5-6. Yeah, so basically two people for five domains. There was a challenge to regroup this this team. And and of course, the beginning was pretty hard because there was no strategy. There was like four separate data engineers. There was no team, basically, where on paper it was a team of data engineers, but basically there's none, because they didn't have any system, they didn't have any rules, they didn't have any agreements, and so on. So what I started doing is, of course, to create those agreements, to create the rules. So we started, I think, from pull request rules and policies, and we started doing unit tests, we started doing clean code stuff, with what code is clean, you know, what linting is using, like the small details which can make, you know, the stylish things, but still it helps to build the team from basically from scratch. And the beginning for talking about the tools was basically everything was built with Python, well, most of the things Python and front. Actually, we had plenty of APIs and plenty of Python scripts on each API. So it was, I have to do something because it's not working. No logging, no error handling, you know, it was really hard. And for me, worked in Barbora. So the experience in Barbora was we have a team like a good DevOps software engineers, guys, you know, and that was a different. And when I came here, it was more as analysts, you know, analysts who became data engineers. So of course, the paths are changed. Yeah. So there's an infrastructure data engineers and there's another data engineer. So I had to have a people that also can work on infrastructure. And I found the people that can work on in this field, and we start building the platform. So we start using, well, I need to remember right now. So what the biggest changes, of course, it was ingestion tools. So we brought ingestion tools. We bring in transformations with DBT, and with DBT it was, you know, the whole new era, let's say, on transformation. We built Spark cases because we have like a lot of data and we need to transform it quick. We built Airflow, which is a data orchestrator. We don't want to use CrunTab anymore. And I suggest nobody should use CrunTab unless you are the company of two people, maybe three. Of course, we start using cloud. We already use the cloud for BigQuery, basically. So yeah, we can count it as we use cloud, but we start using cloud for more purposes. For example, storing raw data into the storage, you know, creating instances for you know, for sensitive data, for example, for collecting enrichment things and so on. Started using Docker, unit tests, as I mentioned, more data quality stuff. So you know, basically all that. It's not the default one, the common data modern data stack that we try to implement, and we achieved that one. And then, of course, as I mentioned, agreement culture. So it is now agreement culture in our team, and basically everything's under the agreements or policies, I would say. So, you know, starting from, branching, DBT models, unit tests, and so on, you name it, yeah. Okay. And then we started working on a Scrum, which also wasn't there. Basically, the team was worked as an ad hoc principle, you know, and even not Jira ticket, but Slack ticket. Well, everyone can write a Slack message and we can fix it, yeah, the approach. So we start working as a Scrum. So, you know, all those Scrum events, sprints, sprint retro, planning, review, daily Scrum, and so on. Also establish new positions. So right now we currently have basically four different positions. So we have of course, data engineers who was working with business things, so with business data engineering, yeah, helping people to get the data. We have analytics engineer who's responsible for transformations. We have MLOps engineering who's responsible for deploying machine learning models. And we will have a platform data engineering guy who will be like DevOps guy for our team, like DevOps team, let's say, and they will be responsible for infrastructure only. It's really hard to find that those kind of guys. So I think it will be, you will promote this, this podcast will promote this role, I would say. And so yeah, establish new position. Everyone knows what they're working on. And yeah, of course the team grew to 9 people. So from 4 to 9, which is also a huge upgrade during a year. And what else changed? Well, and it changed that from team lead to head I became. So this is also a huge change to the company and to me as a data people. We start, promoting ourselves and start making the conferences, start going to some other conferences and so on. So this is, I think, the biggest changes during that year, almost a year.
That sounds like an amazing journey you had, and actually, very interesting, to see how you will evolve, going further, because I guess, you get hungrier, right? The more, you see the value of the things you get, right? So I guess more of the business people will come, and will ask questions. But, what kind of hooked me is that when you mentioned actually data quality, right? So, and you mentioned contracts, though the contracts, I guess, were on a bit different context, but not on the data collecting side, right? Are you using data contracts?
Not yet. We're thinking about it because, of course, with the software engineers and our data engineers, we should have a contract, but to implement it, it will be a challenge. And yeah, but basically, if we are talking about the challenges I didn't mention, so actually, this is one of the biggest challenge during the year, and it's not solved yet, I would say. We still have some gaps between the communication between that. And also, the biggest issue, I would say, overall during that year is the combining business needs and platform needs. Of course, everyone wants to work with the platform. Nobody wants to work with the business, but business sees our benefits of our team, and the combining of that is a challenge, the huge challenge. That's why I really want to split the data engineering teams, to focus on those things. And yeah, these are the challenge to us like that. And of course, as you mentioned, data quality also a huge challenge even right now, but I hope all the companies facing those data quality challenges.
I guess that's an ongoing issue for everyone. No matter what you do, you will never get to like 95% good data, at least, right? You're always like somewhere around 80 and like, then up, down, up, down. Okay. So you mentioned talking to business, and that's where I have like actually a very interesting question, right? So how does business actually sees the value of data engineering? Like, or how you show, that you bring value to the company, right? I know that usually people notice that something is not working when data is down, or like, there are huge delays. So then they go, to data engineering, oh, what's happening, why it's late? How in general is the communication, and like, how business sees ROI of data engineering in your company?
Yeah, so a good question. I didn't manage to show that the benefit of data engineering in Barbora, but I managed to do it here. So basically, not only me, of course, the whole department of ours. So the structure of the data team right now, that there's all the engineering teams, which is, my team, and there's the other team, which is led by my colleague Mantas Zabarauskas, which I know also was in your podcast. So he is leading data science and data analytics. So basically the business department. Yeah. So it's like a back end and front end, pretty much the same. And we decided on scaling data teams. So for example, if you want to have two new data analysts, you have to get one data engineer or analytics engineer. Of course, it depends on the scope that we have. So the business sees this. So if they want two new data analysts, they should have like three FTs instead of two. So this is, of course, the thing. Also, I am showing I'm showing data engineers to the business from such Scrum events, for example, sprint reviews, which are done by data engineers. So when we are at the end of the sprint, we are having a meeting with the stakeholders, a separate meeting. So, and we are showing what we've done, what obstacles we are seeing, and we try to show that data engineers is the core actually of what is happening. And if you want something new, you have to come to us. And yeah, basically that's it. The scaling, I think, is really important. You have to decide, because if there will be a new data analyst team or data science team, so we are doomed, let's say. So yeah. For example, like three more people are coming, and that means three new tasks during the sprints should probably will come to our scope. So we have to solve this by scaling.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I guess in general, what I see, you know, is that, and why I ask this question is that from my perspective and experience is that usually, you know, that business facing people are the analysts or data scientists who actually, you know, work with the data, right? Yeah, it looks, they're presenting and whatnot, and engineers, you know, usually on the like on the other side, right? It's invisible work, you know, and only when something goes wrong, you know, then people come complain. And I guess what I wanted to ask, right, is that usually engineering teams, in this case, you know, like basic data engineering teams, are actually seen more of a cost centers, you know, because not really like a lot of people in the company usually knows what they do and what's happening in that side, right? So coming to the next question, you know, so how are you educating your business people apart from, you know, inviting them to, you know, these Scrum reviews? Because data literacy is a very important topic, and without it, or like, you know, people without knowing some things, it will become troubling for the business and for the data teams in general. So what's your plan on this, on data literacy?
So basically, we got lucky that our management is data-driven people. Yeah, so of course we want firstly to build analytics self-service, yeah, that everyone can use those analytics platforms. I'm not gonna teach them how we are getting the data. Of course, there is a lot of people in our company has that onboarding plan when you have to face the heads and, you know, C-level people in our company. So of course I can show those schemas that I drew, how our data flow is coming, but basically it's not that important. The most important part for business is to see those analytics, you know, those BI visualizations. And to build self-service is, of course, is a challenge, and we are facing it right now. We want, you know, to create some trainings for the whole company, and they can use it, those analytics. But in my case, I don't want, you know, to go a lot deeper into that technical part, because it will be a pain for everyone, basically. I'm trying sometimes, of course, I'm trying to explain what is happening, but I see the eyes, and that's it. And that's enough for me, you know.
But that's true, right? I guess, you know, going too deep of in some of the details, like you'll just lose your audience, and that's it.
Also, I want to mention that we have a pretty nice role chain, I would say. So we can start from, you know, data analysts, and they are coming to analytics engineers. Analytics engineers request the data from data engineers, and this is a nice looking chain, which is easier to explain to the business how to go from, let's say, from source to inside, how everything is going. So not only that, okay, data analysts should do everything, but we need other roles to support each other.
Okay. Yeah. That, and then it comes, I guess, in a way, a full circle, right? They actually see, yeah, you know, yeah, who's doing what and why we have to have that additional FT if we're planning something. Okay. So going back to the data quality, right? So how are you currently, you know, ensuring, like, across all of your pipelines, you know, the data is processed correctly or, like, you know, to your standards?
Okay. So, again, it's built under 1 year, so it's not that perfect. Although my mindset is saying that each data roles, each data layer should be responsible for data quality, no matter what. There is no specific role that is responsible for data quality. So, for example, as a data engineer, I want to, you know, to create to write a nice unit test, you know, for that, for the code. I want to create a good looking logging. I want to create comprehensive error handling. So all those small details, which is led by, of course, data engineers, is responsible for data ingestion. I would say so. The data ingestion, you want to load as much raw data as possible. Yeah, so as raw as possible. Data analytics engineers responsible for data quality in the transformation field. So, of course, they have a good tool, DBT, which is, you know, good for DBT tests. Of course, there's like more libraries, packages for that, great expectations and so on. But currently, we're using only DBT tests, starting from default ones, you know, to the custom ones, anomalies and other things. And we start building a data quality layer, of course, in analytics field, which is they are started doing the QA part, so quality assurance for their dashboards, for their metrics. They established, I think, a few months ago, a metrics dictionary, you know, which is also, you know, a problem for some companies, I would say, and align everything with business. So. So I think this is the and I'm not talking about data science stuff, because of course they are probably used pretty much the same thing as data engineers, but still their things are haven't built yet in our scope. But currently, what I want to say that each layer, each position is responsible for data quality, and we shouldn't blame any of the people, especially data engineers. I know that people likes to blame data engineers for data quality, but it's not.
It's collective responsibility across all of the organization. It's hard to, you know, explain to other people, you know, like not to throw things over the fence and like, you fix it now. It's your problem.
Yeah, and cool. We can actually go to software engineers, you know, the developers who build the core of the data. Yeah, and of course, they should be responsible for their data quality. And, you know, even the business sometimes responsible for data quality, because they are creating the metrics, you know, and they should understand what is in those metrics. So everyone is responsible, and we shouldn't blame anyone.
Okay.
Or nice. Everyone.
Nice, nice. So since you mentioned, you know, metrics that layer, you know, where people, you know, decide of this, how much data engineers are involved in that?
In general? Data engineers in the metrics dictionary?
Yeah.
Zero.
Zero.
I mean, the data engineers in our scope, there is one that is, well, kind of responsible for one analytics engineer who is responsible for metrics. But data engineers, I actually don't want for them to know a lot about the data itself. They should be responsible for ingestion, basically for raw data, for the data lake. And I don't want for them to be responsible for transformation and metrics.
Can you elaborate more, you know, how you built that metrics dictionary? Is it like, I think you're using Looker, maybe you're using those calculations, or you're using some other front end for that?
So metrics basically should be in DBT and documented there. So that's why we are building it. So everything, all the documentation, all the metrics is in DBT.
So you're using the metrics feature from DBT.
Well, I need an analytics engineer aside me, and he can answer you.
No, it wasn't a tricky question, because I'm like very interesting people who are actually using that feature. Because if I'm not mistaken, they released it like at the beginning of the year, I think, for the public. But they have made a lot of changes. But they made a lot of changes since they acquired, you know, transform.co, which actually, you know, were the tool for creating those, like in general, for the metrics layer. So that's interesting. But I guess would be fun to talk, you know, to to your analytics engineer actually to understand, you know, how he's using it and if it's actually, you know, useful or like, you know, how broad can it be used and how it's easy to work with. So, but anyway, that's for offline or maybe, you know, a different episode.
Part two.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So that sounds like actually, you know, you have like a lot of things under control and you're moving quite fast in the right direction because you mentioned a lot of things and, you know, over a year time to achieve that and that quite of a big company with a lot of actually data consuming, you know, in general and from different ways. Like, it's insane. So kudos for that. And like, you know, good luck for keeping up with business requirements and not being flooded, you know, with like too many ad hocs and firefighting. Because usually that still happens. No matter what you do, you know, it's not 100%, you know, sure that nothing will break. But for the second part of our talk, for me, it's like interesting to get your view on two other topics or like areas. One is mentorship. Another one is like, you know, your participation in one of the academies for like preparing, you know, people. So let's start with the lecturer part, right? You mentioned it's quite similar to lead role. And yeah, I understand. I understand the aspects of it. But for me, interesting, you know, is like why you agree to that in general, right? And what's the hardest things actually, you know, while doing that lecturing?
Okay, so to be fair, I would say that lecturing overall, it was a game changer to me, as I mentioned. So yeah, I decided to become team lead or the path changed, yeah, my career path. So why I decided, I'm just thinking, you know, how to say it properly, basically money, basically money.
Well, it's honest answer, come on.
Yeah, man. At that time, I thought I had a lot of free time and I know Python, I know SQL, why not 4 hours per day, you know, four times per week to lecture things. But yeah, it was really hard basically, but learn a lot of stuff or remind me a lot of Python, especially stuff. So because of money, but also I really want at least to try. I think I am a good lecturer. My mother is a lecturer, you know, so I think I'm pretty good at it and I really want to try it. And yeah, Code Academy wrote to me one time and after I think 3 months, I started my first course. Yes, it was a data science course. It finished. And after that, I decided, okay, it's really, really hard to do everything, you know, didn't have that many time as I wanted. And, you know, you have to, 4 hours is only a lecturing, but of course you have to prepare for that and everything. So 4 hours preparation, 4 hours lecturing. So you don't have any weekends and that's it. The biggest challenge is, I don't think there was a huge challenge there. So for me, the biggest challenge was to prepare. I am like perfectionist. For example, I saw the examples or the exercises that they prepared and I didn't really like it and I changed it. So, you know, I had those kind of small details and to create an exercise is a huge, huge challenge. So for everyone, especially, you know, lead roles who created the exercise or like interview, homework for the interview. So it's really a hard thing to do. And when you have to do it almost every day, so it was a challenge to me. And that's it. So the students were great. I really liked the company overall. It was only the good things about the Code Academy and lecturing experience.
Okay, so I'm going to follow up this with one question. Did it in a way push you to become a mentor in the organization?
No.
No? Different reason. Because I thought, you know, how it's like, you know, usually, you know, if you're a lecturer, right, you see how people develop, right? You can, you know, shape them in one or the other direction, which is actually a lot like very similar actually to the mentorship in general.
But, you know, about the mentorship vibe, is not that long time ago, was, you know, is, well, not established, but became that huge vibe. Mm-hmm. At that time, when I was a lecturer, about mentorship, yeah, maybe I heard about it, but never thought that in Lithuania you can do the mentorship thing. So it's not related to lecturing and mentorship, but of course there is an experience to talk with people, especially the people who is not from your field and want to become, for example, data people. So of course it's a good experience, and it's easier to mentor right now.
Okay. And so how did you actually then decide, right? Because I think you didn't start them both at the same time, and it's like, what's the journey like, or what was the transition, right, from one to the other?
So you mean how I decided to become a...
mentor, yeah.
A mentor, okay. So, of course, my goal was to build the name of myself, and of course to have a better network. Yeah, so more people should know me, should know my experience, and that I exist overall. So the first goal was like something like this. I really like to help people, especially if they want a help, which probably will be your next question about the mentorship overall. So the initial thoughts was something like that. I didn't knew at that, I don't know how to say it, but I didn't know at that time that it will be my, well, it's not a part-time job, but it will it takes a lot of time to me right now, and yeah, but I really like it. The experience is great.
Would you say, if you would go back in time, right, like I guess, like, you know, before you moved to data engineering field, right, what would you say are the benefits in that state, right, to get a mentor, and why it's kind of, you know, like in some situations it's kind of a huge benefit to actually have a like a mentor?
So I think the biggest benefit, of course, is that the mentor can summarize the information what is needed for that field that you're looking for. So at the beginning, for me, especially when you're looking into the data engineering tools, yeah, so it's really hard to find what I need to learn. Do I need to learn everything that I become data engineer? And it would be really nice to know that somebody would say to me, for example, okay, just focus on this field, and focus on data engineering or analytics engineering, and which tools do I need to learn, for example. So it's a huge benefit, because I save a lot of time for that. And of course, the internet, in the internet, or like there's like many courses right now, I know, in data engineering, and the famous people are creating those courses, yeah, and they are like 8-9 months and cost like $10,000s. Is insane, is insane. And you don't have to spend that many of dollars, especially in Lithuania, yeah, when everyone is needed for data engineers, but you just need to learn like 3 to 5 key skills, and you can become whatever you want in data field.
Yeah, okay. Like, what I also think is also, you know, helps you that you can, that the mentor actually can give you a bit of a different perspective, right? Because of his own past experiences.
Yeah.
And I don't think that actually in general, you know, like looking at Lithuania's landscape, right, we don't have many communities actually where people are actually doing a lot of sharing, or like, you know, just discussing the things, right? I guess it's a bit of our cultural, like, nationality in general, right? Keep things to ourselves, you know, like we're opening up, I guess, you know, so.
Yeah. And we are trying also do some conferences. I know you are trying to do some events in this field. So I think maybe data people are not that aware, you know, that these things are happening. Maybe they don't use LinkedIn some that much. So it's really hard to answer why it's that. But for example, when from my experience in mentoring, so there's a lot of people who wants to become data people. I would say data people, most of them wants to be data analysts, of course, but some of them, of course, want to be a data engineer or analytics engineer. So there's a lot of people who wants to be like that. And for a senior person, it's really hard. It's really hard.
That's true. So, well, what are the challenges? You know, like we're talking a lot about the benefits, like actually having a mentor, right? But from mentor's perspective, right? What's the not advertised things, you know, what you have to deal with.
Okay. Okay. So basically the main challenge is that people are disappearing. So basically as a mentor, I always, you know, want to collaborate with enthusiastic people, you know, that, that they want to ask questions, you know, ask for the meetings and so on. And most of them are not like that. So they are disappearing. They just have a one session with me, mentorship session with me, and that's it. They're disappeared. And I'm that kind of mentor who don't ask a question. So if you don't, if you are not proactive, basically you are not asking me. So I'm not going to, you know, write to you and or let's have a meeting. Yeah. So I think that this is the biggest challenge here. The other challenge, of course, some people don't want to listen to what I'm saying. They have their own opinion. So this is it's not that usual thing. It's only once in my mentorship experience happened, but still there was a person who didn't listen to me, and she just ignore my what I said. So this was also negative part of mentorship. And but I think if you are at least a proactive person, you can achieve like results pretty quickly in this field, and no matter what mentor you are choosing. But basically I think just be proactive and want to learn, and that's it. Even though you are hearing like anomaly stuff, anomaly skills that you have to learn, you know. So then just be proactive and you can find your path. So I would say it's a good thing to be a mentor and to be a mentee also. And of course I'm looking sometimes for my mentor, looking into the overseas, of course, but still it's costly. Yeah, to have a mentor, I saw the prices. So
It depends, you know, like some are doing, you know, like I think this kind of for free and this kind of thing. But in general,
in Lithuania, it's for free. So yeah. Maybe this is also the challenge sometimes. That's why people are disappearing. So this is for, well, not all the platforms are free, but as commitment. A mentors, yeah, as a mentors, we don't get any money, and as a mentees, they don't need to pay any money. So you know the. That's a challenge sometimes to have a motivation from both sides.
Yeah, that's true. So since we talked about, you know, mentoring, you know, like talked about your lecturing path, right? And yeah, now you're, you know, in a leading position, actually, you know, the multiple data engineering, like engineering related teams, right? So my question is like, what would you give, like what would be your advice to listeners actually to be not, you know, the a data engineer, but a great data engineer, like how to stand out in the crowd, and how it will what would make a difference in today's landscape?
I don't like this question overall.
you can choose to not answer, you know.
Yeah, you know Thomas, it's I can say just read a lot of books and watch a lot of courses online, and that's it. You can become a great data engineer or whatever data people as you want. But basically, I have the main suggestions to basically to everyone, and it's no matter are you data engineer or other data position or overall other position. So I would recommend to start building data engineering environment, which means buy a Medium subscription. Spend an hour a day to reading it, because they have a lot of good posts, articles. Yeah, so follow all the data engineers that you know on LinkedIn or like the popular ones. So start building all your feed or your LinkedIn feed with the data things. And of course, the people that are listening can follow you and me, Thomas. Yeah, it's
thank you for the promotion.
Yeah. So that you can get all the data posts, all the data engineering data, all the data engineering posts, and the popular people that you should follow: Zach Wilson, Benjamin Rogojan, I would say something like that. Chad Sanderson, yeah, and from Lithuania there is Aurimas Grigaliūnas, there is you, me. Even though I'm not that active, but they can follow you, and these are that you are building the environment around you. Yeah, so if you can, if you see everything around the data, around the data engineering, it's easier for you to, you know, to top the market, I would say. And of course, mentorship programs, why not to try? And we have a good mentors in Lithuania, so why not to try from them first, and then you can look into other countries. So yeah, that would be my main advice to basically to anyone. But if we're talking about data engineers, so let's assume it's data engineering advice.
Nice. Yeah. Surround yourself with people, you know, you're trying to work with, or like, you know, to be on that level, and that actually, you know, in general, make you see what they're doing, you know, if reading the content and knowing the direction where everything is going. So yeah, that's a very solid and a good advice. So thank you for that. And now my you know, a bit of a interesting question about, you know, how, or like, you know, since you mentioned that you noticed, you know, from the lecturing part, actually your people, you know, like soft skills and like leading area, right?
Yeah.
What kind of things to look out for, right? To notice if you like things, or like, should you stick to the management, like, you know, to the management path, which is a more natural, right, path, at least in Lithuania now, right? Or when to pursue, you know, the IC path.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your like suggestions?
So Tom, you should answer this one maybe, but okay, I will try. I think for this one, you just feel it. Sometimes you just feel it and you have to try it. So I tried mine with lecturing thing, and I felt that it was my path. I think I'm good at it. I get a good feedback from others. So it was a good understanding that I'm okay. Let's try management part. But I would say for this one, better to try and fail than don't try at all. So if you are feeling that you're good at IC, just be a good IC guy, and you can become, you know, the principal, the staff, and you know, lead roles you can have. You can be the technical leader and so on. So you just feel it. There is no good advice. I know that most of the technical people really afraid of, you know, people management, because yeah, it looks really hard and, you know, scary, but you don't know when you don't try. So I think you just feel it. And yes, you, Thomas, also should know this one, so you can also, you know, share your experience here.
Like, I'm mixed, you know, on this. Like, I have no clue. I liked both. I still have no clue what's, you know, next part. I'm like, I'm happy here. I'm doing, you know, I see stuff. I'm doing, you know, doing quite good, you know, like I see, you know, the satisfaction and like the emotions that, you know, the pushing something to production that actually works, right? It gives dopamine, right? And you're happy, you know, doing things, right? On the other side, right, you see people growing, right? You see how they're doing, you know, how they're evolving, how changing, how you're impacting, you know, their lives. And like, it's a bit different, you know, satisfaction, right? And the IC part, in a way, it looks for a shorter term dopamine boost, right? Because you can see impacts quite fast, right? But with people management, you have to build it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, yeah, one sprint, right? You can see, you know, your results. With people management, quarter minimum, right? So you can see, you know, and shape the people. So yeah, so for me, I'm a bad person to give here advice, because I still haven't figured out what to do with me.
So it's related to what I just said, you know, you just feel it. And yeah, that's it. Right now you are feeling happy. And
yes,
that's the main goal.
Do what makes you happy, right? If you're happy, do this. You know, it's not like, you know, it's set in stone, right? If you choose this, you cannot jump to the other role, right? You can choose whatever. If you feel that it's your time to go back, you know, from people management to IC, do it. Why not, right? If you see that you're willing to try things out, you know, people management, do it. What could go wrong, right? And in a normal company, it wouldn't be an issue to move, you know, across different, you know, roles. And I think we talked with Jeff from Vinted about this as well, right? That actually, you know, you can move from these. And there are good examples, you know, of people in general moving from one role to another and actually doing a great job, right? If they're miserable, right, why be there? And so on. And I guess it was a push from the previous. culture, like, you know, basically in Lithuania, where there was only one path, right? You just go to the manager. Want to go up? You're just the manager. And yeah, but
So actually we fixed this one. We created a good career ladder. So the end goal is not the manager. The end goal could be a lead role in your field, or even we will create a staff role next year. So career ladder shouldn't be only that, okay, I'm that good that I can become a manager. It's not about it. So
it's about enabling other people to do their best.
Yeah,
that's what good managers do, right? They figure out a way how to enable people.
Yeah.
Nice. And last but not least question is actually, you know, about the book recommendation, right? Since you mentioned, you know, a lot of things, right? There are a lot of courses and whatnot. So if you had to choose one or two books, right, what would you suggest for the readers to, for the listeners to read?
But it's not related to data, yeah?
No.
Okay, great.
Overall, I'm not narrowing down, right?
Yeah. So my suggestion would be to buy a O'Reilly subscription, first of all. So it would be a good start. But basically about the books. So I would suggest the book that I think a lot of people already read it. So it's The Little Prince of Saint-Exupéry. This is, I think, my favorite book overall of all time. I'm reading this once a year. I really liked that one, even though it's, you know, it's somebody would say it's a childish book or whatever. But it's a great book to have it in your bookcase. Okay, and for the technical maybe, so my favorite book to follow is Clean Code. As I understand, this is a great book overall for programming, which is I really like that this book is not written in the Python language, it's written in Java, so I really like that you can follow all basic rules, and actually our team is following Clean Code style guide, let's say. And the other thing that it's really a pain to read, and but you have to if you want to become the data people, so there's a classic Kimball books. There's a three editions. Three books. There's a Data Warehouse, a Data Warehouse Lifecycle Toolkit, and Data Warehouse ETL Toolkit. And those are the huge books, and it's really pain to read. But basically, a lot of good data books are referencing those books, and you have to read it. You have to read it, and I think those three. Yeah. You said two, I gave three.
It's good.
This is a base of. Of course, you can read Fundamentals of Data Engineering, which is a great book. But it's really hard if you are the new guy. It would be really hard book to read. But if you are more advanced, of course, it's a great book to have.
Loving that you actually suggest, you know, The Little Prince. It's actually I bought it for my daughter, and like actually when she was little I was reading it. I'm like, when I was reading this before, it sounded way different. Like so small nuggets, and I guess when you're reading it like once a year or like, you know, after a period of time, you see it way differently. So
that's why I'm doing this basically. That's why I'm doing this. So you are just, you know, it's like a Simpsons before 10 years when you look into the Simpsons, and right now it's a way different TV series. And the same with The Little Prince. So it's a great book.
No, but it's like, it actually makes sense, right? You grow as a person, and your views also, you know, adopt with how you're going. So anyway, so was very nice chatting with you and getting your, you know, insights on these topics. So thank you for agreeing on this, you know, exciting chat, you know, with me and for the listeners. So see you in the next episodes.
Okay. Bye, Thomas. Bye, listeners. Have a nice day.